What I thought I would do today then is to bring us up to date. That is to go over the stories of Genesis until this point being chapter 37, which is where we're going to start next week. That's the story of Joseph. so that everybody is in the same place when we start. Now, obviously, this is going to be a pretty quick tour through Genesis, but just to remind you, those of you who either were not here last week or were here and left last week, any copy of the Bible will do. The translation I'm using is the New JPS translation, which is also the one you're using if you have the Eitz Chaim, but remember, if you have the Eitz Chaim, that is the red book, that you only have part of the Bible. You have the five books, but you don't have the entire Bible, and sometimes we make reference to other parts of it. Okay, anyway, so I want to start by, as I said, going over the stories up to now, and the question of whether the universe has a purpose is actually answered at the beginning of the Bible, because God creates it. And this actually is going to be the essence of the debate, I assume, which is whether the world has an architect or not, because the universe can have lots of purposes. That is, everybody can generate a purpose given the universe can have a purpose the way the kitchen has a meal. That is, the kitchen doesn't create a meal, but it gives you the raw materials to make a meal yourself. In the same way, the universe doesn't have a purpose according to some readings, but we all can create a purpose in it because there's enough raw material for us to do that. But that's not how the Bible sees it. The Bible assumes that the universe as a whole has a purpose because it's created by a directing intelligence. And that's the beginning of the Bible. And one of the interesting things is that when it says in the beginning God, or either, there are two translations, either in the beginning God created, or probably more accurately, in the beginning of God's creation, so on and so forth. The idea behind that is obviously that it takes God already for granted. The Bible never argues for God. God is the presupposition. What makes this phrase worth dwelling on is the way that the Talmud and then Rashi, who's the most important Jewish commentator, interprets it. They ask, why does the Bible begin with the creation of the world? In fact, why do you need the whole book of Genesis, since Jewish law doesn't really start till the 11th chapter of, or 12th chapter of Exodus? And they ask, why do you need all these stories? Why do you need God's creation and all that? All you need to do is to be told what to do, right? You just need a law code. And Rashi's answer is very unlike ours, I think. Rashi's answer is, this is to show that since God created the world, God gets to assign whatever land he wants to whomever he wants, and so when God assigns Israel to the Jews, it really does belong to us. Now that's quite a leap for why do we talk about God creating the world so that we get Israel, but in some ways it makes sense given the Torah, because all of the Torah, despite the fact that it starts with creation, all the Torah is in some ways directed towards the idea of getting the Israelites into Israel. That's really what the book is about, after all, is, I mean, once you get through the opening chapters, and we all know that the opening chapters of the book sort of stay hazily in your mind once you come to the end of the book, right? How many people, when they finish the novel, remember how it started? You have to go back and look at it again if you want to understand it. By the time you get to the end, it's all about getting into the land, Moses getting into the land, David and Solomon being kings of the land, on and on and on. So in fact, there is this sort of funnel structure to the Torah. It starts off very, very broad and gets narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower, narrower until you get to Israelites in the land. How you get there is actually going to be the subject of today's class. So you start off with God's creation of the world, and the point is the twofold in creation. One is that God creates everything, and the second is that creation is a matter of division. There are lines drawn between the heavens and the earth, between the sun and the moon, between creatures that fly and creatures that crawl, between human beings and other animals. All those things, creation operates by slicing things apart, as though there's one great undifferentiated mass of creation, and God gradually makes it understandable and graspable by separating this from that, light from darkness, for example. And if you think about it, what existed if light and darkness were together before they were separated? It's impossible to conceive of. What is light darkness or dark lightness? But it shows that we're born into a world of division. And in fact, that's true, right? We're constantly, constantly making distinctions between everything that we hear, that we see. And the world starts that way. In that sense, God is a divider, which we don't like to think of that way, but it's certainly true. If you think about the Havdalah service at the end of Saturday night, right? What do you say? Bein Kodesh l'chol, bein Or l'choshech, bein Yisrael l'amin, bein Yom HaShviyi l'Sheshet Yemei HaMaaseh. From light to darkness, God makes division between light and darkness, sacred and non-sacred, Israel and the nations, Sabbath and the other days of the week, right? All divisions. And then once human beings are created, which is the last day of creation, the sixth day of creation, there's another division between male and female. And that division between male and female, which seems, depending on how you read it, as though Adam starts out as one being. One way of reading this, and one of the ways that the rabbis read it, is Adam starts out as one being and then gets split into two. In other words, Adam is a hermaphrodite. That is, he's male and female, and then gets split into two, which is why uniting is reuniting, right? Two are supposed to be able to become one. That idea is clearly in the text, and once again, it's God dividing, because none of the animals are suitable for Adam to be a husband to, so God has to literally take Adam's self, Adam Eve, he's one person, he, she is one person, and split them apart, which is the idea of Eve coming from Adam's rib. Then Adam and Eve dwell in paradise. There's one thing they're not allowed to do, which is, of course, what they then do, and that's eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, whatever that means, and we had a class on that. I'm not going to go back over that at the moment. But again, it's division, right, between the perfect world and the world that they come to know. And also remember that the first thing that they do when they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil is they clothe themselves. They're aware of the fact that they're naked. So those two things, that is mortality, that they're going to die, and sexuality, those things, not only are they fundamental to human life, but they trace all through the Bible. Reproduction, women who are barren, women who are fertile, who sleeps with whom, who dies when they die, all of that, like every human story, is part of the story of every one of the patriarchs and matriarchs in the Bible. It reminds you of what Hemingway said, that every true story ends in death, which is true, right? So I don't know if you ever saw, there was this wonderful movie that I don't know if it was wonderful now, it was wonderful when I was a teenager, called Brian's Song, about Brian Piccolo, who was a football player for the Chicago Bears and died of cancer very young. And I remember this was a big movie when I was in high school. And the movie starts as follows. It says, Hemingway said, every true story ends in death. This is a true story. Very powerful opening to the movie. I'll never forget that. Anyway, so it was about the friendship between Gale Sayers, who was a black football player, and Brian Piccolo, who was a white football player who died of cancer. It was a very moving story. Anyway, so Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden. They're going to die. They're going to reproduce. In fact, it's the first thing that they do. As soon as they leave the Garden of Eden, the first thing they do is reproduce. Now, literalists will ask, once Cain and Abel and Seth, their children are born, where did they get wives? It's clear that the Bible, it's not that the Bible, you have to assume that the Bible is not stupid, that it realizes that if you believed literally that those were the only people alive, that would be a problem. But it's clear that it doesn't believe those are the only people alive, because all of a sudden, they're married and they have kids. Well, they're married, they have kids, right? So it's clear, at least to me, from my point of view, that the Bible does not intend you to take literally the idea that Cain, Abel, Seth, Adam, and Eve are the only people alive in the world. Because it doesn't even bother to say where they got children from. Which must mean that they're telling you the story of these people to tell you the story of these people, but not so that you will actually literally believe that somehow women materialize from nowhere. The first story then of siblings, and this also is going to trace throughout Genesis, the first story of siblings is Cain and Abel, which is also the story of the first murder. Which is reassuring if you have more than one child to know that this, you know, that this is the first story of siblings in the Bible, and nothing has changed. One of the things that makes this so powerful is that it doesn't exactly say what Cain and Abel are fighting about. And the idea is that the world is big enough that clearly there's enough for Cain and Abel to share, right? I mean, it's not as though there's limited resources. They have the entire world between them. And it shows that the roots of human conflict are very deep in people. And people will fight over anything. And it's not because there are limited resources alone, it's because there's something in human nature that causes us to struggle with one another. And even though you might, I mean, look around us. We live in a world in which there is more than enough for everyone's needs. I'm talking about very specifically in our city, in our community, and yet does it stop people fighting? No, it doesn't, right? People can fight over businesses that are worth millions and millions and millions of dollars because they're going to get slightly fewer millions than the person next to them. Not because it actually matters in terms of their ability to survive, but because of what the Jewish tradition says, which is we all have good and evil inclinations in us, and we have impulses to generosity and impulses to aggression. We always have. So Cain kills Abel then is forced to wander. He becomes homeless. And that's his punishment for what he does. And this also begins what is going to be, obviously, a very powerful theme. And what I'm trying to do is sort of show the seeds of all these various themes as we follow them through the Bible, a very powerful theme, which is the theme of wandering and of home. In fact, Elie Wiesel says that's why the Bible begins with a bet, right? Begins with a bet because that's the first letter of the word for bayit, which means home. And the Bible is really all about a search for home. And he says very nicely, because he's Elie Wiesel and he makes a nice drash out of this, he says, and that's because when the Jews were wandering, the one home they had was the Torah. So there you have, so that's what happens with Cain and Abel. And this chapters 1 through 11 are often called the primeval history, that is, before Abraham, which feels more historical, less mythological. But now we're still with Adam and Eve and then Cain and Abel. Various things get invented along the way. I'm obviously going to skip some stuff. I just want to mention two more stories before we come to Abraham. It's clear in some way that if you look at God in the Bible, God is not the God that we know from the Jewish tradition. Because when God sees how the world is going, God regrets having created it. Now, God shouldn't regret things. Among other things, God's supposed to know everything in advance, so how can God regret? But the God of the Bible is much more human-like than the God that we learned about in Hebrew school. Right? God gets upset, God gets angry, God regrets, God gets persuaded by people to do things or not do things, on and on. Okay? At the moment, we're not going to worry about how the Jewish tradition explains this. It comes up again and again and again. I'm sure it'll come up again. But God gets upset that the world isn't going the way he planned. Okay? Among other things, God is sort of he-ish in the Bible. It doesn't explicitly say God is a male, but it uses male reference almost always to God. So God destroys the world, picking one person, Noah, and Noah's family, by extension, to be saved, and obviously all these animals, is going to start the world again, because the first try didn't work. So this is the second experiment now that God tries in starting the world. The first experiment, remember, is upended by what? By human nature. But, of course, you have to ask yourself, well, who created human beings? God did, but maybe God's not so happy with his creation and what he did, so he's going to start again. Now he's going to start with Noah. Now, the idea in some ways between starting with Noah is maybe Noah, since Noah has proved to be righteous, maybe it's possible that the spawn of a righteous person will be better than the spawn of Adam, who, after all, wasn't chosen because he was righteous, he was just created. So maybe Noah will be better. Well, of course, we know that Noah isn't better. And among other things, Noah has problems with his kids right from the beginning. And the second time the world proves to be less than what God wished. And the story that follows immediately on the heels of the flood, after God shows this beautiful rainbow and says, I won't destroy the world again, and all the seasons will repeat, and so on and so forth, as if God is saying, okay, look, I did the best I could. I'm not going to destroy the world again. We'll see if you guys do any better. And immediately after that follows the Tower of Babel. And once again, God gets upset with the world and feels as though it's necessary to intervene because the world is going in a way that he doesn't like. So right after the flood, human beings build the Tower of Babel, and for whatever reason, whether because it's built in arrogance or hubris or because God wants diversity, right? Because the Tower of Babel is actually an argument for diversity, since everybody until then spoke the same language, God destroys the tower and scatters the people all over the world. So there have now been essentially three attempts, creation, Noah, and Babel, to make the world a better place than it's been. And part of this third attempt is, God now seems to realize that conflict and division and diversity is built into the human system, that we're not actually so constituted as to be one. And so, the new pedagogic strategy, God's new idea about how he's going to make the world better, is he's going to pick one representative people and try to make them better and see if their example can spread to the world. And that's how you get to Abraham. Because remember what God says to Abraham, you will be blessed and you will be a blessing to others. In other words, I'm going to show them through you how this is all supposed to work. Now, the rest of the Bible is in part a demonstration that that doesn't work either, because the Jews endlessly give God trouble, right? But that's at least the strategy. So now you get to the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, which begins a whole new saga. In some ways, the book of Genesis really divides up into 1 through 11, and then 12 through, I think it's 50. That is the beginning, which is the creation of the world, God's unsuccessful attempts to make the world perfect, and then the narratives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Okay, so now we've gotten to chapter 12 on our way to introduce what we're doing, by the way, for those of you who came late, is we're bringing the story up to the story of Joseph to start there next time. So Abraham and Sarah, first of all, remember what Rashi says at the beginning, those I mentioned, that the story is ultimately about how the Jews get to Israel. So Abraham and Sarah get to Israel right away, but of course it's not theirs yet, right? God says go, they go to Israel, but first of all, it's not theirs, and second, what you discover again is that the promise and the vision and the hope is never, never as good as the reality. It wasn't when God created the world, and it's not when Abraham and Sarah go to Israel. Because when they go, what's the first thing they face? Famine. And they have to leave. So they go to Israel, but there's famine in the land. They have to leave as a presaging. As a presaging means that they, before, you know, it's like a hint of what's about to happen. They have to go down to Egypt to get food. This reminds you of anything that we're going to be studying this year, right? They have to go down to Egypt to get food because there's famine in Israel. Abraham says that his wife is his sister. We've gone through this a couple of times. I'm not going to divert us with that at the moment because he's afraid that Pharaoh is going to take Sarah and make her his wife and kill him if he's actually married to her. Anyway, they're saved. And eventually then the struggle becomes the struggle of offspring. Sarah is old, she hasn't had any children. She gives Hagar to Abraham so that he can have a child with Hagar. This turns out again not to be a successful strategy because they have a child together, Ishmael. Then Sarah feels upset about the whole idea that Ishmael's running around the house and is Hagar's kid and not her kid. And so Abraham throws them out, they get brought back. The point is Ishmael is relegated to a secondary role, okay? He's going to go create his own people, but not going to be the bearer of the promise that God gave to Abraham, at least not in the Hebrew Bible. Quran's a different story. Not the bearer of the promise that God gave to Abraham, In fact, that's going to be Isaac. So at age 100 almost, God comes to Abraham and Sarah and says through angels that you're going to give birth, and finally Isaac is born. Once Isaac is born, Sarah, not long after, dies. There's this dramatic story of the Akedah, right, of the binding of Isaac, where immediately upon the fulfillment of the promise, God tells Abraham to take Isaac up to the mountain and sacrifice him. Why God does that, lots of possible interpretations. The most generous interpretation, the one that does God the most credit, is probably the interpretation that human sacrifice was very common in the ancient world. God wished to make a point that human sacrifice was no longer permissible. There are actually a number of comments in the Torah against human sacrifice. You can't just say human sacrifice is not permissible. Instead, God stages a drama, which is more effective than a sentence. God actually shows that Abraham would be willing to sacrifice his child and then says, this isn't the sort of thing that I want. I want the same kind of devotion. The fact that you're willing to shows me that you're the right representative, but God doesn't want the act, right? So it's a transfer of the kind of devotion that people have when they would actually sacrifice a person to God. I don't demand less obedience, less devotion, less passion than gods that claim they want human sacrifice, but I'm not a God that wants human sacrifice. Okay, that's the most generous interpretation. It may be the correct one, who knows? Nonetheless, after that happens, Sarah dies, Abraham gets Isaac married off, and it's looking for the first time as though, in fact, the line will continue, and whatever it is that God has in mind for these people will come to be. Then again, just as we think that the line will continue, we're upended by Rebekah's barrenness. Remember, Rebekah comes from relatives, because we're trying to keep this all more or less in Abraham's family, because God chooses a family to create this people from. And Rebekah is barren. She has pain in childbirth. Finally, she gives birth to Jacob and to Esau and Jacob. And once again, as with Ishmael and Isaac, the younger proves to be the one that God chooses, not the older, but the younger, a motif that recurs throughout the Bible, will recur again with Joseph, who's younger. And it's not just that Jacob is younger, but it's also that Jacob, in one way or another, gets the birthright by coercion and by deception. Aided and abetted by his mother, Rebekah, he fools his old blind father into giving him the birthright, and Esau is aggrieved and plans to kill Jacob when the time allows, but he wants to wait till his father in particular has died, so that his father doesn't have to experience that tragedy of one brother killing another, which of course reminds us that this really does happen in the world, because it happened to the first pair of brothers. Cain kills Abel, right? These motifs keep recurring. We'll see it again, right, where the brothers plan to kill Joseph. They don't in the end kill Joseph, obviously, but brothers killing brothers is something that happens over and over again, at least in theory, in the Bible, if not in practice, from the very first pair of brothers. So, which is either very discouraging or comforting, depending on how you feel about it. Because when people say, why don't we, you know, how come we all can't just get along? The biblical answer is because we never did. We're not built that way. We're actually not all built to get along, and getting along is difficult, as opposed to just the natural way to be. Esau does not kill Jacob. Jacob runs away. And now a sort of different phase begins, in the sense that Jacob is the first character in the Bible who clearly undergoes a tremendous personal development and change. Abraham doesn't so much. The Abraham we meet at the beginning and the Abraham we meet at the end are more or less the same Abraham. Abraham's character unfolds, and we talked about that, the difference between those two things, development and unfolding, last time, and the difference between a short story and a novel. But Jacob's character really does change. He's young, he's arrogant, he's entitled. Remember, when God comes to him with the ladder, with the angels going down and up, he says, you know, if you take care of me, and if you bring me home safely, and if you give me this, and if you give me that, then I will follow you, and God agrees. Abraham then goes, Jacob then goes to Laban. He works for Rachel, with whom he falls in love. He ends up marrying Leah, then later marries Rachel, so he has two wives. And once again, we know, because we know this from Sarah and Hagar, that two people having children by the same man is going to cause conflict. You just know this. And it's not just that you know it from human nature, although you know it from human nature, but you know it because the Bible has already told you. So it's no surprise when Rachel and Leah, in fact, have conflict between them. There's arguments about who gets to sleep with Jacob, which is at least in the Bible depicted less as an issue of possession of Jacob than it is an issue of who gets to have kids. It's really about fertility, less than about Jacob. Now, we don't know what other elements are there, because one of the things that you discover is that the Bible, and this is worth, we'll return to this when we study Joseph. We all know this, but we don't always focus on it. The Bible gives you snapshots. The vast majority of the lives of the characters of the Bible are undescribed. We know 3, 4, 5 incidents in the stories of the biblical characters that we think we know. We have no idea how Rachel and Leah fought about Jacob, because it's never described. We don't really know what their daily life is, because it's never described. We don't know what Jacob said to his friends at the local saloon about Rachel and Leah, because it's never described. All we know is one argument about children, from which we have to extrapolate what all this was about, but it almost is, it's not a movie, right? It's a snapshot. And from each snapshot, you have to decide what the rest of the life is like, but it's really very little information, if you think about it. And think of how distorted your life would be if somebody took 4 or 5 incidents in your life and made that representative of everything you are. So once there is this fight between Rachel and Leah, Jacob starts to realize the promise that was made to Abraham. Remember, what God says to Abraham is, you're going to be more numerous than the stars of the sky or the sands of the sea, which never comes true, has still not come true, but at least Jacob shows the promise of becoming a people, because he has numerous children. And one of the things that we know, again, from the study that we've already done, is having numerous children is a guarantee that there will be fighting among them. And it doesn't matter how much stuff you've got, because that's just how human beings are. Once you put them all in the same house, they're going to struggle for whatever the inheritance is, and there's going to be strife between them. Now, let me just highlight one or two things, and then we'll take comments and questions, because we're more or less up to the Joseph story. Even though you may notice that we really, of all the characters in the Bible that we've mentioned so far, of all the male characters in the Bible, the one that we say least about is Isaac. That's really because Isaac doesn't have much of a story. Isaac is in some ways the link between Abraham and Jacob, and the two great stories of Isaac's life are stories of his being acted upon, as opposed to his being acted, as opposed to his acting. One is the story of the Akedah, of his being taken up to the mountain to be slaughtered, and the second is the story of his being deceived by his children. The two stories where there's an active principle in Isaac's life really is, he reopens the wells that his father had dug, and also he does the same thing that Abraham did, which is he claims that his wife is really his sister. But neither of those is the kind of story, you know, of Abraham, for example, arguing for Sodom, which is one more thing I want to highlight in just a second. So Isaac is the least active of the patriarchs, for reasons that we can speculate about, doesn't matter why at the moment. But one thing that Abraham does model at the beginning in arguing for Sodom is, and I skipped over that story but didn't mean to, is first of all the idea that God will accept legitimate challenges. Moses does this too. To God, right? God will accept legitimate challenges from human beings. Abraham gets upset that God is going to destroy Sodom and says, you shouldn't do this. If there are any righteous people in that city, you have to spare it. And God says, okay, and then they bargain how many righteous people. They get all the way down to 10. And second is the beginning of a tradition in Judaism. Jonathan Sacks points out that when God says, Jonathan Sacks being the chief rabbi of Britain, he points out that when God says, it's one of the very, very few times in the Torah that we actually get to hear God's thoughts. God's about to destroy Sodom, and God says, should I conceal from Abraham what I'm about to do? So Sacks points out the only time you hide something from someone is if you know they're going to disagree with it. Right? You don't hide something from someone if they're going to go, that's great, unless you want to surprise them nicely, right? You only hide something from someone if you know they're going to disagree with it. So what God is doing, says Sacks, is he's deciding, do I want Abraham to argue with me or not? And the fact that he tells Abraham means that God is saying, I want human beings to argue with me. It's an invitation to argument, is how Sacks puts it. And that's a wonderful idea, because in the Torah, and even more in later Jewish tradition, the idea that we're being invited to argue, that it's not a tradition of pure submission, that it's a tradition of argument, is really, I mean, it's woven into the fabric of the Jewish tradition. It's still to this day, right, into the fabric of the Jewish tradition. I told that story before, but I'll tell it again. Years and years ago, when I was on an interfaith panel I think it was Cal Poly. The Muslim representative of the panel, and I no longer remember who it was, said what he objects to about the Jewish tradition is that there is this idea that you can challenge God, that there isn't submission to God, who after all is omnipotent and omniscient and on, so on and so forth. And I said that that was absolutely true. As Jews, we take pride in that. We don't think that that's a weakness, but that's clearly a difference in the two traditions, right? The idea that you can challenge God is shot through the Jewish tradition, and it starts, after all, with Abraham. Anyway, so that also is part of the tradition, and it continues with Moses later, although ultimately, obviously, the assumption is that acceptance is the highest religious value, because sooner or later, as the Book of Job tells us, we only have a tiny glimpse into God's design. So there you have, now we've come up to, and I say that in part because that's the conclusion that Joseph is going to come to at the end of the Joseph story, but we've come up now to the story of Joseph. So let me stop there after the recap for any questions or comments about anything up to Joseph. Yes?
Why didn't God just, before Noah, why didn't he just start all over again? Why didn't, what is the message in that? Why, if he's omnipotent and he can do anything he wants.
Create a new world?
Yeah.
There is a midrash, by the way, that God created many worlds and destroyed them before the creation of this world. This is a midrash that is very popular these days because physicists believe in multi-universes, right? Not just one. So, you know, we Jews, we always like to think we got there first. We say, yeah, the rabbi said that thousands of years ago. I think that there are at least two possible ways of reading it. One is that the Torah is just reflecting what is. That is, God created an imperfect world. And so it's just telling the story of what the way the world is. But maybe the other idea is that part of the message of the Torah is that life is supposed to be a constant struggle for goodness. And if it's too easy, or you can do it automatically, then there's no struggle involved. The great question of human life is whether God got the percentages right. You know, would it be better if God made us just a little bit better than we are, considering how awful human beings can be? Yeah, Matt. As what? I can't hear.
God as a protagonist.
Yeah.
The story is a tragedy.
Yeah. It was Saul Lieberman that said that, and maybe others before him. But when when someone asked Lieberman, who was a great Talmudic scholar, who was the saddest character in the Bible, he said God. Because God is the one who keeps getting disappointed by what he... I mean, God's... in some ways, I suppose, God's expectations of human beings are higher, not than we can meet, but than that we do meet. Over and over and over and over and over again. And God seems to fall in love with those few people that occasionally meet his expectations. But even they only occasionally meet his expectations, right? Because Moses sins, David sins. I mean, nobody does as well as God hopes they'll do. Nobody. So, yeah, God, I think that it's clear that the way the system is set up in the Torah reflects the way we see the world, which is that it's a very close race between good and evil in this world, and sometimes one way outpaces the other. And what Maimonides says about how you should think about yourself on Yom Kippur, that your sins and your good deeds are perfectly evenly balanced, and at any moment, whichever one you do will tip the scales, that's really the way God sees the world. And of course, apart from theology, what makes all of this so frightening in our time is that our sins now have the possibility of really destroying us, which is a function of technology. Just, you know, it's one thing when you're a small tribe, but it's another thing when you have such powerful weapons. So it becomes more urgent to be good than it used to be, not less urgent as we become more powerful. Yeah?
What do you think is the message behind the fact that there are two stories of creation?
Well, this is we did classes on this, and I don't want to go over it too much. The question is why there are two stories of creation. The very brief answer is you can see them as two separate documents of the Bible. You can see them as the way Soloveitchik describes it, that one is basically technological man and one is existential man. And he traces through, we did a couple of years ago when we did that story, we did a class on Soloveitchik's reading. It's called The Lonely Man of Faith, where he traces Adam 1 and Adam 2 through that story. And the other is that one, which is sort of a small piece of what he talks about, the other is that one is about the creation of the human being individually, and the other is about the creation of the human being as a pair, both of which is true to our experience of life. By that I mean, look, everybody here right now is purely and completely enclosed in yourself. I mean, in some way, every human being is ultimately alone. You can't help that. Most of what you think and most of what you dream and most of what you experience, you will never share with another human being. Whatever 100 thoughts have passed through your mind in the last half hour or 45 minutes, no one else will ever know. Maybe they'll know one of them, two of them. Right. So the idea that the creation of the human being is single is true to our experience. We are all irredeemably single, right? This is, psychologists talk about when the child starts to say I, or when the child first realizes that he or she can lie, which is an amazing thing, right? You can say to your parents, I did not take the cookie, and they don't know, which is when you realize that they're not inside you. Because when you're an infant, you think your parents are inside. You don't know the difference between inside and outside. And it's a tremendous feeling of power when you realize they're outside, but it also means that you're alone in there, which is a feeling of loneliness. Now, the second side of that is that our most profound experiences of life are experiences with other people. Almost always, not always, but almost always. So creation is both singular and plural. That we have a profound, deep, unquenchable need for other human beings, and yet we are single. So both of those things are reflected in the creation stories. And both of them are still true. Yeah.
Regarding the story of Cain and Abel, since this is such a major story, don't you think that with all the instructions in Torah and Talmud about how man should live, shouldn't there be suggestions about how to resolve conflicts, especially especially with sibling rivalry?
Well, there are suggestions in the Talmud about how to resolve conflicts, lots of them, and in Jewish literature. So yeah, there's a tremendous discussion about what conflicts are and how to resolve them. That, in some ways, that's what all of Jewish law is about. It's about how to resolve conflicts, right? That's what all of law is about in general. If there's no conflict, you don't need a law. So
but it doesn't talk about sibling rivalry. Right?
Right. It doesn't talk about sibling rivalry in the story of Cain and Abel, but it certainly talks about it in Jewish law, an enormous amount, and in Jewish ethical literature and so on. But the and also especially in commentary, and we'll come to it, on the Joseph story. There's a lot of discussion about sibling rivalry and about how parents have to treat siblings in order to not create sibling rivalry. But it's and in fact, in some ways, you know, there's even discussion about God's role in this, because God accepts, remember, Abel's offering and doesn't accept Cain's, which is what seems to be part of the motivation between of Cain's. But on the other hand, God doesn't accept Cain's offering because Cain doesn't offer the best. Abel does. So it's very, I don't think there's any formula, as much as we discuss it, that will prevent human beings from being in conflict with one another. But there's a lot of discussion in the Jewish tradition about resolving conflict. Yeah.
I was wondering if there can be a connection. You know, you're talking about God created the world through division. It seems to me that people create humanity through differentiation, in which conflict is inherent, and then the issue becomes not to avoid conflict, but how to hold it. Or the paradox is in that connection between.
Right there, you certainly can't have a creative and fertile human society without conflict and without ambition. And it's like that midrash, that rabbinic teaching, that one day the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, was tied up. And the next day, no one laid an egg and no one built a house, right? No chicken laid an egg and no human being built a house. Because you can't divide up. We all know people who are nice and sweet and passive and don't do anything, right? And if the world was filled with people who are nice and sweet and passive, we wouldn't have a polio vaccine. And if you read about, for example, the competition between scientists to figure out the structure of DNA, it was cutthroat, you know? But had it not been cutthroat, we might not know the structure of DNA. So yeah, there's a lot of discussion. In fact, that's what there's a phrase in the Talmud that the jealousy of scholars increases wisdom. And the story that I love to tell about that, which is such a beautiful story. I mentioned before Saul Lieberman, who was, as I said, a great, maybe the greatest Talmudist of the 20th century. In some ways, he certainly was. And probably his most illustrious student was David Weiss Halivni, who is still alive. He lives in Israel now. And when I was in rabbinical school, Halivni had already gone to Columbia. And Columbia is at 115th and Broadway, and rabbinical school is 122nd and Broadway. And I heard that he was teaching a Talmud seminar at night to his PhD students. So I came to him and asked, since I had never had the chance to study with him, could I sit in on his Talmud seminar? And he was very gracious, and he said yes. And there were only about 10 or 11 of us. It was great. I mean, it was just amazing to study with him in this small group. And one of the reasons why it was so great is these were all his PhD students, so he didn't only study, he also told stories. And he told the story, I mean, he came through the camps. He had some very powerful stories to tell. But one of the stories that I remember very well that he told was that when he became a professor at the seminary, his office was across the quad. The seminary is built in a quad, across the quad from Lieberman's. And he and Lieberman had this unspoken competition for years. They never said it to each other. Whose light would go off first? 2 o'clock in the morning, they would look across the quad to see if the other guy's light was on. Because if the other guy's light was on, he was still studying. And they had this agreement, when you were done studying, you turned the light off. You didn't cheat and leave your office and leave the light on. When you're done, you turn the light off. And some nights he would stay up later. He was a lot younger. Some nights Lieberman would stay up later. But he talked about the fact that there's no doubt in his mind that he learned much more Talmud because Lieberman's light was on. And I thought of that as a perfect example. You know, he wanted to be, I mean, look, he was very frank. He wanted to be as great a scholar or a greater scholar than his teacher. That was his ambition. That's what you're supposed to want. you know, while at the same time always acknowledging that Lieberman was his teacher. So there you go, yeah.
So would you suggest that God might have conflict within God's self to have keep trying to create a better world each time?
Well, there are midrashim, and especially mystical midrashim, that talk about conflicts in God's self. If you study Kabbalah, Kabbalah is really all about, in some ways, God's internal dynamics and psychology and conflicts in God's self. If you look at the beginning of the book of Job, there's a beautiful little book called The Story of Job's Beginning by Meyer Weiss, who's an Israeli Bible scholar. And he analyzes the beginning of the book of Job in terms of God's conflict with God's self. Because what happens, remember, in the beginning of the book of Job is that there's this, there's Satan, right? Which is, after all, God's omnipotent. So Satan is really just sort of God's functionary. It's not that it's an independent spirit from God who challenges God. It's God's functionary. And God says to Satan at the beginning of the book of Job, "Have you seen my servant Job, who is upright and wonderful and worships me?" Now, nobody asked God to say that. Satan didn't say anything about Job. God raises the whole question. And you know and I know that when you say, "Have you seen my wonderful child who loves me so much," that you must have some doubt, or you don't have to go around saying how much your kid loves you. So Weiss, you know, says that there's this conflict already inside God, and the book of Job is in part playing that out. You could certainly analyze it that way, and as I've said before, if you're interested in the way the Bible depicts God without rabbinic tradition, then the book to read is that really wonderful book by Jack Miles called God, A Biography, which won the Pulitzer Prize and deserved it, which tries to read what God is like just by reading the Hebrew Bible and not making any assumptions about what we know about God or think about God or what theologians say about God, but just by reading this book, what does it tell us about the God of this book if you only read the Bible? And it's a brilliant, wonderful book. And he was trained as a Jesuit priest. So he has a religious background, not a Jewish background, he has a religious background. And really, it's excellent. Okay, so yeah.
As you've been talking about conflict, a number of our kids who are, I know in the fourth grade, are getting the bullying dialogues, and our kids are telling us that that's happening.
Right.
But I'm not hearing anything about this perspective, the Jewish perspective or the biblical perspective, and if it is in our roots or in our origins, how we approach it that way. And have you thought about doing that, or could you do that with our kids?
It's an interesting idea. Well, it is an interesting idea. I don't know whether that perspective, I'll tell you one place that you can get that perspective is in our parenting seminars. Every parenting seminar that we've had, and we've had a bunch of them over the past few years, has had a Jewish perspective. Wendy Mogul's books, if you read them, have a very Jewish perspective on exactly these questions. Just came out with a new book that I just got in the mail her first one was called The Blessings of a Skin Knee. This one's called The Blessings of a B Plus, I think, or The Blessings
B-minus.
Of a B minus. See, I have this Jewish thing. There's no blessing of B minus. B plus, okay. I'll have to tell her. Next time I see her, I'll have to tell her that I inadvertently misquoted that. But I don't know whether they get that perspective or not, and they just filter it out when they tell you about it. I mean, I certainly know when I talk, for example, to the eighth graders about sexuality, and I give Jewish examples that a lot of them have heard them many times. It's not as though this is the first time that they've heard that. So I don't know. But you should absolutely ask whoever's doing the bullying seminars. The other part of this is that the best that we can do, not the best, for the most part, is recognize two things. One is that your kids' characters are going to be shaped infinitely more by what you do at home than by what they tell them here. They just are. And you see this often. Already, by the way, in the preschool. Already in the preschool, you see parents who will set limits for their kids and parents who won't set limits for their kids. Happens very early. Parents who get upset at the preschool teachers because they are setting limits. Happens very early on. And the second thing is that I've discovered this late in my career that one of the most powerful things that the school can do, actually, or that a rabbi can do, is give someone a, what you call in Hebrew, pichon peh, which is literally a mouth opening. In other words, you can say, one kid who gets bullied can say to the other, weren't you listening to what so-and-so said earlier today? In other words, if you have a shared experience of an authority figure saying X, Y, or Z, then you can go home and say to your wife or husband, didn't you hear the rabbi just said yesterday that saying something like this is illegitimate? Because then it's not, you don't, you know, everybody wants to disclaim, it's not supposed to only be on your responsibility. And that teachers can do for kids. But I don't think a lecture is going to stop a kid from bullying, or even Torah examples will, but what they will do is give someone reference points, and that we should absolutely be doing. If they don't, they should. Okay. With that, so next week we start on Joseph, starts on chapter 37. You're more than welcome to read the story in advance. And I look forward to seeing you next week.